Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Gascast. This month in our needles and local anaesthesia themed episode, we'll be reviewing ways to improve epidural anaesthesia in labour, looking at the importance of ultrasound guidance when doing tap blocks, and talking about current research into cardiac arrest. And as if that wasn't enough excitement, we've also got an interview with Andrew Morley about anaesthesia at the Science Museum, as well as our usual discoveries, question of the month, and biology or bunkum. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
And Frank Schneider.
Hello there.
So, what is the verdict on our new very flashy theme tune?
It's a bit retro 1980s Magnum PI, but it's quite cool.
I'm glad you said that. I thought it was very much Holby City meets Beverly Hills Cop.
So it ticks all the boxes.
But if those pen pushers up in Sydney Hall think we're not going to cut corners to get the job done, then they've got another thing coming.
I like it. So thank you very much to my sister for doing that for us. And if you've got any comments, please send them in. But otherwise, we'll be keeping it, I think, as long as that's the general consensus.
Yeah, I'd keep it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure your sister's available for freelance musical work if anyone would like it.
Yeah, if your podcast needs a theme tune, get in touch and I'm sure she'll be able to knock something up for you. With that excitement at the beginning of the show, we move on to our discoveries. So, as usual, we'll go around the table and see what discoveries everyone has made this month. So, Bex, what new things or strange practices have you discovered in Canada?
I have come across someone who had a diagnosis, she told me, of something called a catamenial pneumothorax. So this really tested my poker face, and I quietly excused myself for a bit of sneaky Googling behind the wall of the pre-op assessment clinic. And basically what this catamenial pneumothorax is it's a condition which goes with endometriosis. Now, I never thought endometriosis was going to impact my anaesthetic practice at all, but apparently you can get endometriosis in the thoracic cavity. And according to my frantic research, there's two types. You can get parenchymal endometriosis in the lungs or pleural endometriosis. Now, the parenchymal one, it's thought to have an embolic pathology where the patients present with intermittent hemoptysis, whereas the pleural ones, it tends to affect the right lung of patients. And these patients typically have tiny holes in their diaphragm. And so it's thought that the endometriosis enters the pleural cavity from spread and seeding from the abdominal cavity. And that's the more common one. So what this patient gave me a history of was that she used to have these cyclical pneumothoraces that sort of coincide with her menstrual cycle. And she had to have pleurodesis for it, which I thought was fascinating.
I mean, that's also horrific, getting a pneumothorax once a month.
It beats TMT, doesn't it?
Surely you'd go on to some contraception. Like double time.
Isn't that amazing? I never knew it existed. So, yeah, I was fascinated.
That's a good medical word as well, catamenial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, what the origin of that is.
Did you manage to walk back into the room and discuss it at length with her, pretending like you hadn't just Googled it?
No, I thought it was a bit too risky.
With such confessions then, moving round, Frank, what bounty have you presumably plundered from the Apple store this month?
Well, actually, I wasn't going to give you an Apple Store iPad-esque news item, but now that you've pushed me, I think I might have to, because that's just reminded me that for those of you fortunate enough to have iPads, and Mark, I'm glad you've joined the Brotherhood, you may know that there's a couple of journals who are now producing for iPad, and specifically, I was just thinking of anaesthesia and analgesia as well as anaesthesiology, which for, I suspect, only a limited time period have got iPad apps, which give you access to the full text of their journals. I'm just slightly suspicious it might be a trial period, and then it may well go into a subscription-based service. But whilst it's freely available, I'd recommend downloading the app, and it's probably the easiest way of getting hold of reasonably good anaesthesia journal articles whilst you're whiling away the long plastics list. But my actual discovery of the month was something I came across just last week, actually. And it's a product produced by a company called Imacor, and it's a disposable transesophageal echocardiography probe. Now, being an American company, they've given it a very clever name, and it's called the Clarity system.
Where
T is obviously T-E-E for the Americanized version of T-O-E.
Very good.
And the reason it's interesting, it's actually, funnily enough, obviously I've been doing some cardiac anesthetics, cardiothoracic, and been trying to learn some T-O-E skills. And it's not actually designed for intraoperative TOE necessarily. It's actually meant to be used in intensive care, and obviously including cardiac intensive care. And it gives you a slightly more limited amount of data from a proper TOE, just because the probes are obviously disposable and much thinner as well. So they don't have all the omniplane where angulation capabilities of full-size TOE probes, but you can certainly still get good images, and the idea is that you use them, they can stay in situ for 72 hours, and that you use them for determining things like filling, get an idea of ventricular function and filling, and and you can obviously record images and do some calculations on it to see what your interventions are producing in terms of improving cardiac output. So it's just another tool, really, in the management of perioperative patients, and they're marketing it for support from weaning, sepsis patients, trauma patients, and obviously cardiac ITU. And the reason we came across it, just to finish off, is because we had a patient that was coming in for an aortic valve replacement who'd had a previous esophageal stricture, and for various reasons, there was no time to sort of assess whether putting a full-size TOE probe would be safe or not. And we tried this, which is even slightly smaller probe than a pediatric TOE probe in terms of its diameter, and it passed through very easily. Obviously, there's no resistance to its introduction, and it allowed us to get all the kind of information that you would want to for an aortic valve replacement in terms of the annular size and coming off bypass to make sure it was well seated and there was no regurgitation and so on. So it's on trial at the moment at the hospital I'm working at, but again, like other sort of disposable systems, it's probably going to become more and more commonly available.
Ooh.
I have seen those probes advertised and thought that's a fantastic idea if you can get good resolution with them. It would be really good on ICU where you've got all the intubated patients and you never get very good images with a TEE anyway. Not quite often because of their pathology, because they can't be positioned correctly. So a TOE is always going to give you a better image, but then you've got problems with trying to find someone to get down there, get the right equipment. But if disposable probes are going to be the thing of the future, then they'll quickly become a core ICM skill, I would have thought.
Well, I think the technology is obviously becoming more affordable, and as you're saying, I think TOE is certainly in the UK is becoming there's a lot of interest in including TOE skills in the ICM setting. A lot of ICM trainees now seem to be wanting to go for ultrasound, so either transthoracic, but also TOE training. So absolutely, I think that's one of the areas that are going to develop.
Okay, and so moving on, Mark, what have you got for us this month?
So, well, it's an update really from before. I have now discovered that you can indeed give an RSI with fentanyl, ketamine and rocuronium.
Hooray! It works!
all the theory was there, but now we've done it in practice. So we launched last week. We've been running for just over a week, and we've done five or six now with no catastrophic deaths. So
was that on healthy volunteers or...?
No, mostly unhealthy volunteers in the field.
I wonder if you just drop down in your helicopter and ask, would anyone like to volunteer for some treatment from the strapping HEMS doctors? If anyone would.
In some parts of London, if you offer them some ketamine and fentanyl, they'd probably be lining up.
Absolutely, but no, it's going well, and I thought I'd just give you that update since I've been talking about it quite a lot in the last few podcasts.
And that's, so following on from what you were saying, is that that's now going to be the standard policy, presumably?
Yeah, I would expect that to be rolled out through all of the different HEMS units, certainly in the southeast, over the next few months.
And just remind us, what sort of doses are you using?
So a standard person with who's not hemodynamically compromised will get 3-2-1. So 3 mics of fentanyl followed by 2 milligrams of ketamine followed by 1 milligram of rocuronium per kilo.
Yeah.
And the more unstable or hypovolemic patients will get a 1-1-1.
That's nice and easy to remember. Okay, well, yeah, that's great. Did you have something else to say? Sorry.
No. No, I'm conscious of you trying to jog us on.
No, crack on.
Great. Well, I'm very excited about my discovery this month, which is Twitter Journal Club. This is an absolutely phenomenal idea that's been set up by Fee Douglas, who is a medical student at Cambridge, and Natalie Sylvie, who I think is currently in FY2. The basic idea is very simple. It's a journal club that meets fortnightly to discuss a pre-selected paper. But the execution and the use of social media in this venture is truly inspired. On their website, which is twitjc.com, they announce in advance of the Sunday evening meeting the chosen paper and post a blog with an introduction and points for discussion. They then meet on Twitter at 7 o'clock using the hashtag TwitJC to focus the discussion. The use of the hashtag, for those people who are not familiar with Twitter, means that you can anything anybody posts about it is easily searchable. And you can use applications like TweetDeck to open up a column that filters just the hashtag you're looking for, or use TweetChat to have a chat room where you just get comments with that hashtag. And this all takes place in bursts of 140 characters or less. The idea is brilliant, and a phenomenal amount of work has gone into setting this up, and the girls must be thoroughly applauded. As well as reviewing papers, the website's absolutely packed with links to primary sources, and they archive all the transcripts of the tweet sessions. Sadly, I've not yet had a chance to take part in one of their journal clubs, because I only discovered this last week, but looking through the transcripts, the sessions look really friendly, well-run, with a truly multidisciplinary attendance, including nurses, paramedics, and medical students, as well as doctors of different grades and experience. Twitter Journal Club's already very popular, and they've reviewed some quality papers. It's not specifically anaesthetic or ITU, but they have, for example, covered early goal-directed therapy in sepsis, FEAST, which we did, CRASH-2, as well as the recent Sepsis 6 paper with Ron Daniels, the paper's first author, joining in the discussion. It does look really good, and as I said, I think it's an absolutely fantastic idea. So I'm looking forward to that whenever their next meeting is, as I'm sure are you, Bex.
Yes, because I'm such a Twitter follower.
I think Bex might need baby steps, but it certainly sounds like a great use of Twitter for something that might actually be interesting rather than the latest celebrity gossip.
Precisely. Talking of which, Bex, you're asking about how our Twitter...
How's our following going?
Not well is the answer. Not well at all. We weren't overwhelmed with responses from last episode. At Gas Junkie, who was that guy who was a bit confused about what we did, he's now been joined by one other guy who's... Oh, damn it, I've forgotten his name. I was going to say.
Yeah. You've forgotten him, he's one of two followers.
We've only got two followers, I can't remember one of them.
I've forgotten the name. Oh, no, hang on. No, I've got it. Dermot McGuckin from Ireland. That's probably not how you pronounce his name. But he was following us, so thank you very much to him. But pretty much nobody else. So it's not been a roaring success. But anyway, I've been tweeting stuff, particularly about my frustrations trying to fill in application forms on the London Deanery website. So, moving on to our news items for this month. Bex, you're going to be telling us about a study on epidurals in labour, which looks not at the method of placement or type of local anaesthetic solution given, but instead focuses on the timings and volume of delivery.
Yeah, so this is a study that has come out of Rome in Italy, and was published in October last year in Anaesthesia Analgesia. It's a prospective randomized double-blind control trial, so, you know, design. And what they looked at was labor analgesia in 145 women. And Of those women, the particular population they chose was nulliparous women who went into spontaneous labor with a vertex singleton. And at the time of the insertion of delivery, the woman had to be less than 4 centimeters dilated and had to have a visual analog pain scale, a pain score of greater than 50 out of 100. So what their hypothesis was that if they were giving programmed intermittent boluses for labor, they were going to compare to giving continuous infusions, and that the programmed boluses would reduce the incidence of motor block and instrumental delivery. So I've worked at a few different hospitals now doing obstetric on-calls, and there's various ways in which the midwives manage the epidurals. Some people give boluses on maternal request, so these patients have peaks and trough analgesia, and then some hospitals, they use continuous infusions. Now, it's been found that the continuous infusions, they use larger total doses of local anesthetic, and there's a more profound motor block. These new pumps that they've been looking at, the ones that are programmed, they give less anesthesia in total and fewer manual boluses for breakthrough pain. So these are pumps that are set up to deliver boluses at a determined time interval, with not necessarily on demand. How the study ran is that they would cite the epidural, and then they used computer-generated numbers to put the woman into either the intermittent bolus group or the continuous infusion group. And both groups had the options of using a PCEA as well. Now, they didn't give a test dose. They just gave a loading dose, which was a low-dose solution. They used a 0.0625% bupivacaine with some sufentanil and gave 10 mils of that. Then for the intermittent bolus group, 1 hour after their loading dose, they would give them 10 mils of a similar low-dose solution and repeat that every hour. Whereas for the infusion group, immediately after being given the loading dose, they started the infusion for a total of 10 mils an hour. And then they had the option for the PCEA, this 5 mils of a stronger solution, 0.125% bupivacaine. And you got chucked out of the study if your pain score didn't drop down to 10 out of 100 within 30 minutes, or if you needed your first PCEA bolus dose within 30 minutes. And then on an hourly intervals, they assessed the pain score and motor function, and they were using a modified Bromage score. Now, the primary endpoint of the study was the block, and they used a very sensitive, the modified motor Bromage. So if you had a motor block, even as little as only being limited to flexing at the hips, instead of being able to stand up and do a knee bend, they considered that a motor block. And what they were expecting from previous studies is about a 30% block with the continuous infusion versus 10% with the boluses. Then their secondary outcome was how many instrumental deliveries there were. And they were expecting about 27% with the continuous infusions. And if they only had 6% with the programmed boluses, that would be a significant difference. So what they found, it was a huge difference in the motor block. The infusion group had 37% with a motor block versus only 2.7% in the intermittent boluses. And of instrumental deliveries, 20% of the infusion group ended up with the instrumental deliveries versus only 7% of the intermittent boluses. There have been previous studies using this kind of intermittent bolus technique, and they hadn't actually shown a difference between the mode of delivery and motor block. And it's likely because these studies looked at women who were being induced, and so their labors tended to be shorter, and so they weren't actually having the sort of time necessary to develop motor blocks. Now, I mean, it's just common sense. If you have an excessive motor block, you'll have reduced pelvic muscle tone, and that makes it difficult for the fetal head to rotate within the pelvis, so you'll need an instrumental, and that also is difficult for mothers to push actively during the second stage. But if you look at actual difference in the total local anesthetic between the two groups, it's actually very similar. So it's not the dose that was the difference here, and what it is explained by is the physiology of the epidural space. So if you give it a continuous infusion of local anesthetic into the epidural space, you have a low residual pressure. Whereas if you're giving boluses, you have times of high epidural residual pressure, and this facilitates the spread of the epidural. So you need less concentration. So you can use these very, very low concentrations, like this 0.0625%. Now, the criticisms for the study is, first of all, the numbers are almost too good to be true. I mean, there's hardly any women, you know, there's 6 out of 75 of the bolus group that end up needing to have a PCEA dose. I mean, at my institution, we also use this low-dose solution, but up to 40% of our mothers need to be changed to a stronger solution. So that, to me, seemed a little bit suspicious, and I'm not sure how reproducible that would be. And because of this study design, one group is always going to be ahead of the other in terms of local anaesthetics. So, like, the bolus group only got the dose at the end of the first hour, as opposed to the infusion group, which started straight away. And then, of course, the individual differences amongst obstetricians that decide the actual need for instrumental delivery, that can be a confounding factor. In summary, I mean, people who are getting intermittent boluses had less instrumentals and less motor block. So I just thought, for those people out there that are not obstetric anaesthetists, there might be some light at the end of the tunnel, and that hopefully if we can change practice into these programmed intermittent boluses, you end up with fewer unnecessary trips to theatre in the middle of the night.
Thanks, Rebecca. I thought this was a really good piece of work and also very interesting. It's a silly assumption to make, but I've always thought of epidural infusions the same way you would think of an infusion of drugs in theatre, in that a continuous infusion in a steady state would be achieved, and that would be the ideal way to do things. But of course, looking at sort of intravascular drug distribution compared with distribution of drug into, or locally acting drug into, a space, very obviously two entirely different things when you start to think about it. And I think this really demonstrated the point. And there was a really interesting couple of paragraphs at the back about the physiology of local anaesthetics and how the difference in thicknesses between motor and sensory nerves, and how the different diffusion gradients between extra and intraneural spaces will work with either a big bolus or a continuous infusion of anaesthetic, and sort of hypothesized as to why this causes less motor block, which I thought was absolutely great.
Yeah, exactly. So when you have the continuous infusion, you just end up sort of equilibrating between the extraneural space and inside the nerve. That's how the motor nerves get affected. Whereas if you give the bolus, you have the drug being diffused into the nerve, and then the drug is distributed away from the extraneural space, so the drug sort of starts to redistribute out from nerve into the extraneural space, and so that's why those motor nerves are then never get the opportunity to be totally blocked. So yeah, you're right, it was a really interesting physiology, I thought.
And also, it's I remember when I was in my early days on labor ward, I was always taught that with spinals you're looking at the mass of the drug that's important in giving the effect, but with an epidural you're looking at the volume, which is why I've always gone for lower concentrations and bigger dilutions to get the desired effect, which has sort of worked anecdotally for me, but it's nice to see a proper sort of prospective randomized controlled trial here, which backs that up.
I thought it was a neat study, and it seemed adequately powered, and you know, if that's the way things are going. The only thing I thought is quite clunky is, surely you should be able to build in a PCEA function into the whichever pump you use.
Yeah, I agree. That sounded horrible, didn't it? With this three-way tap kind of bolt-on, two pumps in bag affair.
Yeah. Not only horrible, but I mean, from a safety perspective.
I think you'll have to have a whole new pump, won't you? That they'll have to design new pumps as opposed to just modifying existing pumps. I think that's the downside, is that, you know, well, when will the NHS be able to afford to replace all the epidural pumps? I don't know.
But I mean, pump manufacturers will be all over it if I don't know if you probably could tell us if there are other articles that back up this kind of. Cause, I mean, this was published sort of middle of last year, was it? So I don't know what other evidence is out there with regards to. And they certainly make reference to other articles that have looked at pulsed or programmed boluses.
Yeah.
But if there is good evidence that that's the way to go, then surely in future pumps will be designed to deliver boluses like that, and you should be able to build in a PCA function to just give a top-up if you need one.
Certainly the ones I'm used to only do continuous infusion or continuous infusion with top-up, but not this timed bolus function. Although you could get the midwife to do that. It seems like an expensive use of a midwife.
True.
Oh, I've just got a mental image of a three-way tap and lots of things going into an epidural catheter and a midwife in charge of it all.
Right, I think you should say any more on that topic. Let's get some lawyers. Right.
Well, thank you very much for that, Bex.
Pleasure.
So, Mark, if we come to you next.
Uh-huh.
And this month you're going to be talking to us about...
Cardiac arrest. And this has come about largely because I'm the first to admit that I've usually been fairly cynical about cardiac arrest, particularly in hospital. I would often be the grim reaper who would turn up and insist that everybody leave the corpse alone. And was fairly cynical that not many were ever survivable. But I'm beginning to think that was probably coloured by most of my experience being in hospital in situations where I would still argue that the choice to start resuscitation was inappropriate. In my current role, as I keep going on about, I'm seeing a lot more cardiac arrests out of hospital from people who more often seem to fit into the reversible categories. And so that got me thinking about things as well. And on top of that, I attended a very interesting governance day at London Hems a couple of weeks ago, where the guest speaker was Dr. Jerry Nolan, who some of you might know from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. Is also the co-chair of the International Liaison Committee on Resuscitation and the editor-in-chief of Resuscitation Journal. So he's done loads of work on this, and he basically summarised what's been going on in the world of cardiac arrest, and I'm going to tell you as much of that lecture as I can remember in a much more simplified form. So a lot of interest has been generated recently, and I think we talked last time about the new video featuring Vinnie Jones directing the general public towards chest compression only CPR and no mouth-to-mouth. So that's generated a lot of discussion about whether or not that's what we should all be doing or why that's come about. And I think that seemed to start with a paper in The Lancet in 2010 comparing retrospectively compression-only CPR versus standard CPR. The important thing to remember about this study is this is dispatchers on the 999 calls giving advice to bystanders over the phone. So this is purely bystander CPR, not healthcare-trained people in any way. And they did find that the survival rates were slightly better in the compression-only CPR. Now, that did lead to some slightly unhelpful headlines in our favourite journal, the Daily Mail, who immediately reported that mouth-to-mouth was killing people. I think there was a feeling that mouth-to-mouth, the concept was putting off bystanders from attempting any type of CPR, so that's one thing. And then the other thing that's been looked at quite a lot recently is the idea that for the first 6 or 7 minutes of a resuscitation where you have a reserve of oxygen, it's more important to get some compressions going. And indeed, there is a trial called the Continuous Chest Compression Study that's ongoing that's looking at a 6-minute burst of CPR at the start before any attempt to look at the airway is attempted. So that's where that's come from. The important thing for us is if we're trained in standard CPR and airway management, we should still be doing that. But I think anything that improves the chances of good bystander CPR are worth doing. So there seems to be a fairly constant influx of machinery and equipment, and as usual, companies trying to work out how they can sell us things to improve CPR. Ooh, what was that noise?
It's my chair moving, sorry.
That's what she says, it was her chair moving.
It was! I can do it again!
I don't even know how many times you can do it.
Not helping yourself.
Please carry on.
So one such device that claims that it can improve your CPR is a defibrillator device that gives you constant audio feedback on how you're doing in terms of your rate and force of chest compressions and ventilations and so on. And that was studied in the BMJ in 2011 and showed that these feedback systems improved the quality of the CPR, but that did not translate into an improvement in outcome. So some work to be done there still. Interestingly, quite a significant proportion of people there were switching it off because it was just too irritating, and I can I could quite imagine that.
I was in this lecture, and I'd love to know what that, because they didn't play us a clip of what it sounds like, but presumably, while you're doing your chest compressions, it's giving you advice. So it's saying things like, harder, faster, deeper, less deep, slow down.
That's exactly what it says as far as I know. I remember going to a similar lecture, and someone asked what nationality they'd use to record the voice.
Surely Swedish.
Maybe it's like a sat nav where you can choose your voice.
So you can have Stephen Fry if you want.
So, what else have we got? So, big topic at the moment: mechanical CPR devices. There are two main ones that I know of on the market. There's a Lucas and an Autopulse, and these are both variations on a theme of something you can strap onto the patient that'll do the job of CPR. The obvious advantages of consistency and being able to go indefinitely or as long as your battery power allows you. And the manufacturer of these are dead keen to get them all around the place, and there are lots of kind of YouTube videos, miracle stories around there of people having CPR for hours whilst in the cath lab until they have their original problem fixed and then living happily ever after. But the first big proper trial of this is called the CERC trial, and they've been comparing their automated CPR machine with ordinary manual CPR, and I don't think this is published yet, but the word is that the automated device, they managed to achieve an 80% CPR time, which that means 80% of the duration of the resuscitation active compressions were going on. And just to give a comparison, I think the kind of thing we'd be achieving in a standard in-hospital resuscitation would probably be 50 or 60% at best of hands-on time. So this CERC trial looked like showing that the automated device was improving the percentage of hands-on time and improving survival. Until you look at the control group, where the paramedics involved were kind of intensively trained on how to do good quality manual CPR, and they too achieved an 80% hands-on time and a very similar survival rate. So that's going to be interesting, that these companies might now have to look at pitching their devices as, we know your staff are lazy, so why not get this machine instead? It's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. So I suppose my take-home messages from looking at all of this stuff is there is definitely a lot to be learned and a lot we can do to improve our work with cardiac arrests. I think for the moment the key is getting good quality CPR for as high a percentage of the time as possible.
Thanks, Mark. I, as you said, I was at that lecture as well, and it was really interesting. Much like you, I think I've probably been carrying a fairly negative attitude towards cardiac arrest, especially, as you say, in hospitals. But it was really nice to see so many people who are doing genuinely excellent research in the field of resuscitation and making headways to try and improve outcome. And as you said, that very much does seem to be the holy grail of resuscitation research, is trying to prove some kind of improvement in outcome. Well, thank you very much. So you'll probably all be pleased to know that after last episode's GWAS gate, this month I've taken a break from reviewing papers and got myself out and about. This is an interview I did a couple of weeks ago with Dr. Andrew Morley about anaesthesia coming to one of my favourite places, the Science Museum. Today I'm at Guy's Hospital talking to Andrew Morley, consultant anaesthetist and co-curator of the forthcoming Senseless exhibition at the Science Museum. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to me today, Andrew.
Pleasure, a pleasure.
So, briefly, what is Senseless?
Well, it's an exhibition at the Science Museum. It kicks off on the 25th of October of this year. It'll run for about 11 months, and it's associated with a dedicated area on the Science Museum website, which will be set up at the same time, and a series of public events, most of them for adults, either in the gallery during the time that the exhibition's running, or in the Dana Centre, which is the Science Museum's adult facility at the back, which runs a programme of evening events where researchers get to talk to the public and hear what they have to say.
So how did the idea for an exhibition about anaesthesia at the Science Museum come about?
Well, I've been doing some work with the Wellcome on another project on genetics and choral singing, and they were reasonably pleased with how that had gone. And my grant manager there called me up in June of 2010 and alerted me to the subject of the upcoming Wellcome Trust Society Awards grant theme, which was Grey Matters, Brain Science and Culture. And, well, she rang me up and said, you know, you're an anaesthetist, you must know something about this. How about putting something in? So I went away and had a bit of a think about things. My academic contract was up for renewal shortly after that time, so I felt the pressure was on a little bit from that point of view. And I thought to myself that the Science Museum, as far as I knew, had never had an exhibition on anaesthesia. And so I rang her back and said, look, you know, I think it's a great subject. Clearly, it's what I do, and I enjoy it. And I don't think they've had one before. Do you have any contacts at the Science Museum that I could speak to? So she gave me the name of some people working over there. I went to meet them, and they were keen. The nature of the exhibition was decided fairly early on, in that for the sort of money that the Wellcome were talking about, these society awards are of the order of £200,000. It doesn't buy you a whole wing of the Science Museum for 5 years or sure. In perpetuity. Although it sounds like an awful lot of money, it gets you a smallish exhibition for a limited amount of time. And it became clear, or at least it was clear to them, that the best place to hold it was in the Science News Gallery, which is called Antenna, and that's at the back of the museum on the ground floor. And it's devoted to contemporary science. So very early on, the decision was that this should not be an exhibition about the history of anaesthesia in any way. They're extremely forward-looking. In fact, they get a bit allergic when you mention anything historical. Right. So it's all to do with contemporary research, effectively.
So how are exhibit ideas being generated for Senseless?
Well, clearly we had to come up with something before we started. The Wellcome don't just give you all that money and say, well, now make it up. Exactly. So we had a number of ideas before we started. So that came really out of my own head, but also at that stage, I think the Royal College website had a list of all the academic departments in the UK. And so I went down the list and saw who was doing a lot of active research in areas that might plausibly interest the public, and I contacted most of them, and most of them replied with some speed, and clearly there's a lot of interest amongst research departments in participating, which is fantastic. It's made my job very much easier. So that was stage A, if you like, for the application. Once we knew we'd got through the first round in January of 2011, I had a meeting at the Science Museum with some of the people who contributed to the application. And we talked in general terms about what could go into the exhibition, what areas it should cover, where I might get further ideas and information from. And we agreed that it would be an idea for me to put out, if you like, a general bulletin to everyone out there in the anaesthetic profession in the UK to see if anyone had any ideas, research departments and trainees and consultants and full-time clinicians alike. I mean, everybody's ideas are welcome.
What sort of are the themes that we can expect to see running through the exhibition?
Okay. We agreed fairly early on that the gallery space is not enormous, so covering everything that anaesthetists do wasn't ever going to work. Because of my own interests, I was more interested in the operative anaesthesia side of things rather than intensive care. We also felt at the steering group meeting back in January that intensive care was rather more off subject in terms of the grant theme than anaesthesia was. So Grey Matters, Brain Science and Culture, it's kind of hard to fit the management of sepsis into that. The Science Museum felt that where they have run exhibitions in the past, there's been a lot of interest in consciousness and how the brain works and how the mind works. So we thought that was probably going to be the focus. And so intensive care medicine, we decided to exclude that really very early on. In terms of the themes that are developing now, it changes a lot, really, depending on the conversation. So there are three content developers working on it at the Science Museum, and each of them has taken a little area and sort of developed it. The way it seems to be going for the public development events, which perhaps we'll come on to in a bit, is that the topics that have been chosen are pain, consciousness and anaesthesia, and the clinical process, which I'm hoping will give me a chance. I mean, I shall be talking about that at these public development events. I'm hoping that'll give me a chance to promote some of the lesser known bits of research that are going on as part of the general sort of catch-all topic of operative anaesthesia.
So these public development events that you mentioned, so how do these work, and what's this got to do with audience co-creation?
Right, well, I think there are two things that won us the welcome grant. The first was the early involvement with huge enthusiasm from the college and the association, and I think being able to include, as we did, a letter from the presidents of both in our application saying we think this is a good idea was a great strength. The other one came from the Science Museum, and that was this idea of audience co-curation or co-creation. The way this works effectively, I suppose the easiest synonym is a focus group. So rather than designing an exhibition by yourselves and then showing it to the public, you involve the public at a much earlier stage, and you say, well, here's a whole bunch of stuff to do with anaesthesia and pain and consciousness. So those are the three main thrusts. What do you think's really interesting? What would you like to see in this exhibition? And this is done through, well, we've got two events planned for the end of this month, the beginning of next. So one of them will be with teenagers who are school partners of the Science Museum. They have a link with the Science Museum. They've helped with other exhibitions. So that's a bunch of teenagers, and that will be on February the 29th. And then on the 6th, we have an adult event in the evening, where I think the idea is to replay the same speakers broadly, or the same topics at least. The Science Museum have told me I'm to keep my bit down, which is the whole of operative anaesthesia, to 4 minutes. And the idea being that the other 2 hours will be taken up with conversations, with small group discussions. And the museum are going to have people there recording the conversations and seeing where the public interest apparently lies.
And so the idea of these events then, because it's the Science Museum who are actually responsible for generating the actual exhibits themselves.
Yes.
So they can then look at what comes up in these public group discussions
yes.
and then feed that back into the exhibits they're creating so they're
yep.
more relevant to the public, I guess is the idea.
Yeah, and specifically for this exhibition, and this is relatively unprecedented, two of the exhibits will actually be created by people at those public development events. Not at the event, but there will be an exhibit that derives from the teenager event and an exhibit that derives from the adult event. And at the events, a subgroup of interested people will be, you know, volunteers, I suppose, will go on to create these exhibits in conjunction with the Science Museum and the experts and researchers involved.
Could you quickly just describe what the talkie-okey session is all about?
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. Clumsily named and reasonably easy in concept, but nonetheless absolutely terrifying. So this is a round table with a hole in the middle, effectively, where sits the researcher. It's placed in the gallery during gallery hours. I'm presuming the sessions are advertised internally, so if you're wandering around the Science Museum, you know, there will be a ding-dong in 5 minutes' time. Dr. X and Y will be sitting in the talkie-okey table in the anaesthesia exhibition. And the idea is that the public flood to that table, sit around the researcher on the outer perimeter of the table, and fire questions, and a conversation is generated perhaps between people at the table and the researcher. And it's not a new idea. It has been around a little bit, and I think the museums in general see this as a way of exciting something rather more interesting than the researcher speaks to one member of the public. It's a small group makes for a more interesting discussion.
Have you had any feedback from the Science Museum about what they think or you think the public want to know about?
That's a good question. The Science Museum have told me that whenever they run stuff on consciousness, it's always extremely popular, and they always have lots of people coming to their events where there's an element of consciousness or the mind or the brain. So I think that's sort of in the bag, if you like. That's one area. In terms of specific topics within anaesthesia, I've had a lot of help from the patient liaison group at the college and representatives in that area from the association as well. When we talked about it, before looking at the data, I've said, well, you know, we all know at the bedside the two questions. The main question is always awareness for anyone having a general anaesthesia. That always seems to be the question that comes up with me. And the second one is risk of death. I would have thought that those are the two things that would most concern patients. I'm not sure that they're the same thing that concern people when they're not about to have an operation. So the inquiries received by the Royal College from patients don't bear out that impression. They're an extremely mixed bag about all kinds of different things.
Right.
And in the 50 or 60 inquiries that I was sent by the patient liaison group, there's only one about awareness. The rest are just completely disparate, some really bizarre ones, no apparent theme. So that rather made life difficult for us, really. It's something that I had presumed to be the case doesn't appear to be the case on the basis of that evidence. Specifically with reference to awareness, which is a personal interest of mine, I see this as an opportunity to correct some of the myths, if that's the way that the public want the exhibition to go. They want us to talk about it, so there's an opportunity here to correct some of the myths. And the second opportunity is to use it, rather than being an end in itself, as a gateway to talk about consciousness. And to talk, I mean, the neuroscience of consciousness now is just extraordinary. I mean, I lectured on this the other day, and I said that the surgeons, after 150 years, are rather blasé about our skills. But we don't have to worry about them because we've got new best friends in the shape of the neuroscientists. They're all saying, hey, we've got these fantastic new imaging techniques to look at consciousness now. And you're anaesthetist, so you can actually make people unconscious and then bring them back to consciousness again. So everyone's really interested in the neuroscience of anaesthesia. And I've been reading a fascinating book called Suppressing the Mind, published a couple of years ago, which is written by anaesthetists. And it's about all the research into anaesthesia and consciousness and what we think is happening and the differences between memory and learning and consciousness and awareness, all these terms. Absolutely fascinating. And I'm fairly sure that because the images generated by things like fMRI and the techniques that people are using now to look at the brain are so beautiful, I have a feeling that that's going to be quite a strong part of the exhibition.
This is probably the most exciting type of public engagement event that's occurred in anaesthesia for a very long time. What sort of opportunities are there for trainees to get involved?
When we sat down and talked about how we could continue to involve trainees, the museum were very keen indeed on having trainees at the events that will happen after the exhibition opens, at the evening events. I think these were felt to be much more discursive, if you like, than the hard exhibits in the gallery. And it was felt, well, to put it frankly, it was felt that they didn't want too many old fogies. It would be quite nice, actually, to have a younger voice with some insights, you know, that perhaps wouldn't arise from the experienced researchers. So that's going to be the stage when, you know, certainly I'll be bringing in the trainees that we've already got, plus anybody else that wants to, you know, give me a call if you see.
Thank you very much for talking to me, Andrew. So that's the Senseless exhibition at the Science Museum starting October 25th, and I'm sure we'll come back and talk to you again, if that's okay, after the exhibition has started.
Absolutely.
And see how it's all going.
Great. Yeah, it'll be my pleasure.
So thanks again to Dr. Andrew Morley for doing that interview with me. I'm sure it's going to be very exciting. I personally can't wait to get myself down to the Science Museum and have a look at the exhibitions at Senseless. So last but certainly not least, Frank, in keeping with our needle and local anaesthetic theme, you've been looking at a recent paper in the BJA exposing how us trainees have unwittingly been spearing abdominal viscera with our dirty block needles.
Absolutely. And well, I think we're safe to, I know both Mark and you, I think Rick, had an interest in regional anaesthesia, and one day a very long time ago when I thought I might become a regional anaesthetist, and that sort of coincided with tap blocks becoming quite popular, I had done quite a few tap blocks. But the reason I said we might exclude ourselves from this group, or the group that performed the study, is that I've never done a tap block without the use of ultrasound. And the reason I just flagged this up is I thought it was a reasonably neat study. It was the lead author is a colleague of, or past colleague of mine. So I kind of picked up her name and then saw what it was about, and it was short enough to read. So I went through it, and the interesting bits about it were that two weekends ago, in fact, I did a tap block, and I was with a consultant, and this has happened to me a few times really where, you know, we discuss a tap block and consultants will say, I don't need an ultrasound or don't use an ultrasound. I just use a landmark technique, which is fair enough. And I suppose, so would I. And I mean, I do use landmark techniques for other things, certainly for central venous access at times. In cardiac, you won't necessarily use ultrasound, although that may upset disciples of NICE guidelines. And I probably just didn't know or didn't have enough experience in landmark technique. But what the study does, and I'll just tell you very briefly because the study itself isn't all that exciting, but they essentially, it was set out to have, I think, 60 patients, but really just did 36 patients, obviously bilateral tap blocks, so therefore 72 injections. And they were all done by a sort of landmark technique and midpoint between the iliac crest and the costal margin in the anterior axillary line. And the anaesthetists performing the blocks were blinded to the ultrasound image, but they did do a pre-scan on a ultrasound machine, then looked to see where the needle was and what the needle placement was with the landmark or the double pop technique, and then verified on ultrasound where the needle tip actually was as opposed to where the person performing the block thought it might be. And essentially what came of it was that there were only 17 correct placements, so only 17 or 23% of all of the injections, or 24% of all injections, were they actually placed in the transverse abdominis plane. What was more of a worry, and the reason they stopped the study early, was that 18% of injections were in the peritoneum. And although complications aren't widely reported, there certainly have been some hepatic punctures and colonic perforations and pediatric blocks. So obviously that's not without risk. And in terms of the analgesic effect, obviously a lot of the other injections were just in the wrong muscle layer, so either or subcutaneously, in fact, or within the external oblique or internal oblique muscles. And they go on to say that although there may well be some analgesic effect with peritoneal injection, so obviously local anesthetic may still cause a bit of a block, which may mask the injection being in the wrong site, or that if it was in another layer of the abdominal wall, again, that might permeate through to block nerve endings. But really, the gist of the article, as I understood it, is that we really should be relying on the use of ultrasound if we're to safely place tap blocks, and then obviously the hope being that they will contribute towards postoperative analgesia. So I was really just wondering what everyone's thoughts were, whether anyone has done landmark technique for tap blocks, and what your thoughts and experiences are with putting these in, and perhaps working with consultants who are experienced at doing landmark, and whether there is a change in attitude towards it.
I've done some with a landmark technique, and I must say my success rate, if you go and see patients in recovery stop, hasn't been very high. So I feel I may be having a slightly higher incidence of misplaced block. But I have changed my practice now to using the ultrasound. And I think this is just, it's a real argument again for ultrasound, isn't it? I just think it's the way of the future, it's the way things are going. And that if you do have a complication, it's going to be very hard to defend in the future if you've used the landmark technique when ultrasound is available. So yeah, this is a real argument for ultrasound, isn't it?
What was it, peritoneal
huge
perforation rate of 18% is just frightening. Well, it's so frightening they stopped the study.
Well, yeah, and I think although, yeah, they obviously didn't have any complications, but they did advise the person performing the block if the needle was in the peritoneum. But yeah, you know, almost one in five of these injections, and these were experienced regional anaesthetists in the sense that, you know, they'd done, even the trainees had done a minimum of 50
had,
and some
more
than 100
really
blocks.
Interesting in this paper was that 100% of the peritoneal perforations were done by trainees. So the consultants did none.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, perhaps that, you know, that's an indication of, well, certainly of experience, I suppose, and experience with a landmark technique, which, again, I mean, you were saying about central line placement, but, you know, having recently worked somewhere where most or a lot of the older consultants certainly just never used ultrasound, and you know, have a complication rate that's not going to get any better and is very low in any case, should they start using an ultrasound technique. Because in their hands and with their experience, it's as safe as it's going to be.
There's a... On one of the AAGBI podcasts I listened to, I think it's Steve Yentis, and he's interviewing somebody, and it's about the guidelines for blocks and regional anesthesia, but they made quite a classic comment about which end of the needle is the prick that does the damage, which I thought was quite a legend thing to say on a podcast.
So to finish up... what was that?
Sorry, just
that was not
dying,
me.
Mark.
That's Mark blowing his nose.
You haven't said much today.
Right. I just realised I had my microphone switched off. I switched it off to cough and forgot to put it back on again, so that's why I was trying to butt in with comments and was being ignored. But
have you got anything you'd like us to say? Do you want us to go back?
No, it's not worth it.
Fair enough.
When do you want to do the... I've got the answer to last week's quiz question and a new quiz question for this week.
My little thing here, I've got underlined 5 times, do not forget question of the month. And I've just gone straight past that. So following up on last month's new feature, question of the month, Mark, I know we were inundated with answers, but how many were correct?
Thanks to everyone who's entered, we had literally some replies. And the winner is... Ariane Snurk, who has suggested the answer as Gilze in the Netherlands, which is a small town between Breda and Eindhoven, which is very close. So the math behind this basically was, according to the NAP4 audit, there were 2.9 million anaesthetics in the country, of which 1.07 million-ish were with endotracheal tubes. I told you to assume an uncut size 8, which I make to be 35 centimetres. Multiply that, you get 374,080 metres. Due east of the Royal College is kind of Holland somewhere. Well done. If you send in your address, you'll get a new copy of Rick's physics textbook when it's available.
Does anyone get a booby prize for being totally out or not?
Yeah, you do. You get another copy of Rick's physics textbook.
There were some miles out answers, but that one was worryingly close, so somebody who's as geeky as me. So are you ready for a new question?
I am ready with pen and paper.
All right, it's topical, this one. So going back to my favorite publication, the Daily Mail, they reported this week that Whitney Houston spent $100 million on cocaine. I want to know if she'd turned her life around and decided to go into ENT surgery, how many septoplasties could she have done using a standard Moffitt solution, 10 mils per patient?
How do you come...
With £100 million worth of cocaine.
With $100 million worth of cocaine. Work it out.
On today's exchange rate.
Yeah, at your average South London street rate.
Oh my goodness.
Excellent. I'm really looking forward to the explanation of how you managed to work this out. So to wind up our podcast, we'll be playing our favourite game, Biology or Bunkum, where I'm going to present the others with 3 biology-based news stories, and they're going to guess which 2 are true and which one is a figment of my imagination. This month, I'm going for alternative medical interventions. Number 1. A group from Australia have found that by playing relaxing nocturnal sounds after 10 o'clock on an orthogeriatric ward, they have significantly reduced the need for nighttime sedation and decreased the incidence of falls as a secondary outcome. Number 2. A hospital in the States has been studying the effect of animal-assisted therapy and has found that dogs employed to give pet therapy in the chronic pain outpatient's waiting room lowered depression by 40%, fatigue by 20%, as well as reducing mean pain scores. And number 3, a program of twice weekly hour-long Tai Chi sessions has been shown to significantly improve balance and reduce the rate of falls in patients suffering from Parkinson's disease. So, those are your 3 stories. We haven't started with Frank for a while. So, Frank, which one of those is the bunkum?
Well, I think you've made good choices this month, Rick. I must commend you on that. I think they all sound reasonably believable, but I'm probably going to say the Parkinson's one is bunkum.
Want to qualify that with any reason?
Well, I suppose you'd have to clarify as to what stage of Parkinson's. I just have difficulty imagining someone in late stage Parkinson's with a, you know, shuffling gait trying to do Tai Chi. It just seems a very cruel thing to subject them to.
It does. So, Rebecca, with that in mind, whereabouts would you like to place your chips?
Yeah, I think number three is the bunkum. I remember it's rigidity, isn't it? Rigidity, bradykinesia, the tremor. It would be too cruel to make these people line up and do Tai Chi. I think, yeah, no. Definitely three is bunkum.
Okay, and Mark?
Yeah, I like the idea of that, so I think I will go for the middle one.
The pet therapy. You don't think the pets were helping anybody?
Well, these are all totally believable stories, that's the thing. You've actually got me this week.
What kind of pets? Dogs, was it?
They were dogs.
Mm. All right, let's go. I'll go with number one in the peaceful bedtime music.
Okay, so number one. Number one it is.
Yeah, right.
So, in no particular order, or we'll do number two first, as no one wanted to comment on that one. So, this was in fact true. This was published in Pain Medicine this January and presented somewhere. But this was where this was basically a study where chronic pain patients got an option when they arrived for their outpatient appointment of, would you like to go and wait in the waiting room with nobody in it apart from some depressed chronic pain patients, or the one with the furry dogs where you can play with them. And those who chose to go into the one with the furry dogs then reported that they were 40% less depressed, 20% less fatigued, and had lower mean pain scores. And I think this was actually followed up for some time after they left the dogs alone and was shown to have some lasting effects. But anyway, obviously not a randomized controlled trial as the patients chose to go in there. I'm not quite sure what the science behind that was, but published in Pain, so I guess that's good.
Probably also not any South London pit bulls.
No. There was actually some pictures on the article I was looking at. They were big, fluffy dogs. So that is true. As is the twice weekly hour-long Tai Chi sessions.
No ways.
Which I'm disappointed with you, Frank, because that was published in Nijum.
Of which I'm an avid reader.
You are an avid reader. So you obviously skipped by that or thought it was a joke. But yeah, that was compared with resistance training and some kind of stretching program and showed that they had a significantly improved balance. I think obviously it is pretty early stage Parkinson's, but no, that's absolutely true. So that leaves the story about the relaxing nocturnal sounds in Australia, which, Mark, congratulations, you're quite correct. That is the bunkum.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's not based on anything. I thought that up last night when I couldn't get to sleep.
Did you try playing yourself some soft music?
No. I was lying there. I kind of wished I did have some soft music to play, but I didn't. So I just kind of hummed to myself. So that wraps it up for this show. I hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time.